Okay, today is September 28th, 1998, and I'm Mary Harrison interviewing Barry Paris, and Gabby Dinman is taking notes, and we are at Barry Paris's house. Hi, this is, I forgot, this is the Council of Jewish Women, and this is tape 4, side 7. Barry, we have quite a few things to ask you, but we know that you have just come home from San Francisco, and you were there for the debut of Andre Previn's composing the music for A Streetcar Named Desire, Tennessee Williams' play, and I'd like to hear all about it. First of all, I've already read the reviews of the New York Times, and I certainly read the reviews this morning in the Post-Gazette, and I also have your article that you wrote for Vanity Fair. So I'd like you to also tell me what you think of the opera, aside from all the minute details, how it went, who was there. There.
Well, we'll give you the medium short version, because it was in a real extravaganza. I've never attended such a premiere anywhere. San Francisco Opera had been building up to this for 4 years, and they have a budget, annual budget of $41 million, which is second only to the Met. They do things in high style, and I mean, for instance, the gala opening night party was co-chaired by Elizabeth Taylor and Roddy McDowell. There were 600 people at a $1,500 a person sit-down dinner after it. Now, even if about a third of those were free giveaways, press people like me who didn't pay $1,500, even if only 300 of them paid $1,500 a piece, whatever that multiplication works out to gives you an idea of the amount of money in this place. Anyway, that's all about money. It was one of the social stuff was great. Couldn't begin to. Well, among the people there. Well, the ones that I spent a little time with, for instance, Betty Comden and Adolph Green came. They're good friends of Andre's. And people like, of all people, Dennis Miller, Patrick Stewart, all sorts of Hollywood celeb types and musician. It's Mia that has 14 kids. He has about 8 or 9. And three of them were there, the twins, Matthew and Fletcher, who were the twins by Mia Farrow. They're actual biological children of his. And his youngest son, Lucas, who's about 14, who's kind of a punker. His way of rebelling against Andre is shave his head, kind of like my kid. Anyway, the opera itself, I thought, was wonderful. The reviews were very disappointing, as they usually are. The San Francisco critics basically didn't like it much. The review that ran in the Post-Gazette today, September 28th, 1998, was just a reprint from Chicago, and that woman was particularly nasty, pointing out derivations of other composers that he allegedly borrowed from, Britten, Shostakovich. Basically, I want to say what, you know, remember Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin on Saturday Night Live? Jane, you ignorant slut. This review is typical of the fussiest kind of, you know, Tallulah Bankhead's line, critics are like legless men who teach running. The best review, yeah, that's a very true statement. That's why I've been happy to not be in the, especially music. It's different if you're reviewing a film. And it's different if you're reviewing the 50th version of Carmen that you've seen, or the 900th La Boheme, or the Beethoven 9th for the 20th. You have to review and listen to a new work in a different way. I could hold forth on that, but I won't. The best review, and I unfortunately don't have it with me, but you can find it easily, was in the Wall Street Journal, of all places. And that was on Monday, a week ago today, would have been the 21st. A review by a critic that I never had heard of that stated that it was the finest new opera in 25 years, with reasons why. I won't go into that, because in the end, it's a matter of opinion. And in the end, we won't know in this century. We won't know until we're gone, and then we won't know. Somebody will know in the 21st century, they'll be able to assess whether or not this work is going to stay in the repertory and be performed or disappear. And I think the former. I thought it was brilliant. The aria by, the most famous aria in it is called I Want Magic. And Renee Fleming recorded and released it even before the opera. It's absolutely beautiful. All I can say is that the audience gave it an enormous long-standing ovation, which means something, and that I've never heard such absolute silence in an opera. You could have heard a pin drop all throughout. The criticism in a nutshell of it, the main, is that it's not doesn't have enough ensemble, duets, trios, and not enough aria. And the word enough is what's, you know, a matter of subjective opinion. It does not have many ensembles. Has no chorus. It's only essentially a six-character opera. You can't have an Aida chorus coming in and sing. But the main thing is you can't have ensembles and arias generally in opera without repetition. You know, an aria or an ensemble goes on and on by repeating the phrases. And it's not the words that are important, it's the structure of the music, and you repeat. And this, Andre wrote it with no repetition at all. It's written straight through. It's a linear thing to push the story. It's the story that is pushed, and it's very dynamic. But all that's a matter of opinion. And it was gorgeously mounted, the set, costumes.
Did they have dancing? Because every opera,
Every opera has dancing. Yeah? Nope, no dancing.
I couldn't imagine.
Yeah, there's no dancing. Of course, there's no dancing in the play. One of the accurate criticisms is that he could have done more with, you know, the famous card table scenes. That would have been the logical choice for a quartet, for instance. And he didn't. He deliberately avoided all of the obvious things. He avoided jazz, for the most part. And, you know, everybody, oh, New Orleans is going to be jazz. Andre's a jazz play, you know. It's going to be a lot of jazz in it. No. And, but beautifully, for instance, and everybody's waiting for the kindness of strangers line and presumably dramatic aria, which comes very, very close to the end. And when it comes, it is delivered in the course of it's neither an aria nor a recitative. It's done very subtly and in passing without any special emphasis at all. And it just, it strikes you because you've heard it, but there's no big to-do about it.
Is that when she leaves?
It's just before. Yes, actually it is. It's after the men come,
yeah.
And they, or in the middle of that scene at the end. And she just sings it in complete, you know, consistence with the context, and there's no great drama. Previn is just a very subtle composer. He wouldn't, he doesn't do flashy thing, the obvious thing. So I don't know. You either like it or don't like it. All I can say is the 2,000 people in the auditorium seem to really like it. And I like it.
Good.
And if you want to later on, you can
hear
that little aria.
Roddy McDowell, I hear, is very ill. I read it somewhere.
Yeah, I didn't know that. And I didn't know that. I'd called him the day before to say, oh, I'll see you out there. And an assistant said, he's ill. He can't come to the phone. He won't be making it. That's too. And the item was in the paper. 2 days later. It's horrible. It's horrible. I don't know. It's very upsetting. I don't know how to. Trying to figure out how to, you know, what do you say you write, you call, assuming it's true, which it must be. It's terrible. I'm real down about it. He's the most wonderful person, helpful to writers, and I think I've told you, this is a guy who every week goes to the motion picture home for the old actors and actresses, visits with them, sits and talks with them. It's what he did for Louise Brooks, how I first got in touch with him. So concerned about the older people and history of Hollywood.
He's quite a photographer, isn't he?
Wonderful photographer. 4 books, double exposure. Yes, I wrote one of the pieces in the last one. Somebody who, it's supposed to be celebrities writing about celebrities. Except when he got down to Nancy Carroll and Barry Pera. Nobody had heard of either one of them, but it was nice of him. He couldn't find anybody else to write about her, or who knew about her, because she was a silent, so I did it. for fun, and I'd do anything for him.
Did you get a chance to get Andre Previn's reaction to his performance? And
Yes.
And?
Several times. Myrna and I spent a little time with him and Heather several times. Both after the...
Is Heather his wife or his new girlfriend?
Heather is his wife.
Okay.
16 years. And the mother of Lucas, who was there. And she's very sweet. And we saw them after the dress rehearsal, kind of preview performance on Thursday, and then after the opening on Saturday night. And he's, you know, it's very hard. He's not an effusive, emotional guy, but I think he was very pleased. And his usual droll self. He's basically mortified at all the, you know, the lionizing and the attention, and he doesn't really do well under those kind of stuff, but he rose to the occasion. He was exhausted, as you can imagine. And,
so he's finished now, right? He was going to conduct, what, 4 days?
Four of them, mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think, yeah, he's done now. He's probably back in Martha's Vineyard collapsing.
How long is this going to run in San Francisco?
It's only for another four or six performances. It runs, what's it run? It runs from, well, it opened the 19th, right?
Right, that's what I heard, right?
And it goes 19th to October 11th, but that's only a total of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 performances.
And where do they go from there, do you know?
Well, from there I know it's, among other places, going to Houston, I think Washington. And then the interesting thing for the general public is that there's going to be it'll be broadcast on PBS in December. So you'll have a chance, people have a chance to decide for themselves.
Will he conduct that?
Yes, it'll be of the first, it'll be a compendium of the first two or three performances.
Okay.
It won't be live, in other words. It'll be the San Francisco performance. Either the 15th or the 30th. Something happens on the 15th. Oh, the tape, they taped the score for Deutsche Grammophon. December 15th and December 30th, it's the taping of the opera recording and the PBS broadcast, and I'm not sure which, 15th and 30th.
Okay. Any other comments about your week in San Francisco?
Oh, it was pretty boggling. I think the major highlights that I missed. Interesting little fact is that after the last rehearsal, this is how versatile and professional he is. That apparently, they hadn't done it except for one rehearsal on the actual stage, and it's a gigantic stage, the War Memorial, which is the most beautiful opera house and concert hall. It's just had a $20 million restoration, a little bit like the Benedum, beautiful place. Gigantic stage, and for the finale, when Blanche wanders off at the end, or is taken off at the end, after, I've always been on the Kindness of Strangers, whoever you are is the last line, and she says it four times, the only thing repeated, and says it as she's very pianissimo, as she's walking off in the back, and it's, and as the stage, which rotates, the set, is moving around to return to its original position. And the problem was that, first of all, it's a very pianissimo note, and the stage, which is, I mean, the rotation device, makes noise. It's rather quiet. In a fortissimo music, you wouldn't hear it, but with pianissimo, it was rumbling, and it was messing up the sound. And the distance she had to walk was twice as long as there were musical notes to cover it. So he had to, at the night before the opening, write 10 or 12 or 15 new measures of music to get her off the stage and to get to cover the set, the sound of the set. It's a kind of amazing person. He just tossed that off, like, evidently on the spot. That's fascinating for you. I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens. It's a new work. And why these idiot critics. Bernie Holland. Ah, one last thing. Bernie Holland, you mentioned the New York Times Review. What a schmuck. This guy, man, and he's a smart man. I knew him for years here before he left here and went there to New York. So full of, as most of these critics were, of their own psychological interpretation of Blanche. Well, Blanche is really, you know, her deterioration should be something that is, who cares what your opinion of Blanche is. But in the course of that review in the New York Times, which was basically a semi-pan, he managed to not once to mention a single aria or a single specific musical moment. It was all this vague generalities of the Previn and the Straussian and the Blanche and Tennessee. It was such a bad review, not just in terms of negativity, but in terms of what the review, the function of a person reviewing a new opera. You don't have to list, if you're doing Carmen, you don't have to talk about the Seguidilla or mention the Habanera or, you know. But if it's a new work, anyway, the great Bernie Holland of the great New York Times failed to do that, so it's no surprise that some chick in Chicago, anxious to demonstrate her knowledge of Shostakovich and, you know, Lady Macbeth of Lutensk and Britain, and, they're so critics, and I was one of them, so full of the need to demonstrate their own importance and their knowledge.
Will you review it?
I reviewed it privately for Andre.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I can't. I'm too much of a partisan. I loved it, and I love him, and I did my thing in Vanity Fair. So it would be, anyway, I felt bad for him because his reviews were so negative. And although he's a pro, he didn't run out and jump off the roof.
They're also gossiping about his marriage right now.
That was unfortunate. I think it was a stupid item, for which I got blamed because I was the only, they attributed it to no one and put my name in there as, it ran the same day as the excerpts from my Vanity Fair ran in the Post, so it looked juxtaposition of the two, like I provided the item about Nancy Garris and so. And I demanded a correction to be run in the Post Gazette, and they refused. I've been on my high horse lately without much luck. But I'm a little protective of Previn for all the good it does. And I thought it was wonderful. So I just wrote him a private thing of my impressions.
Was Robert Crumb there?
No, he wasn't. He said he wanted to go. This was before, but he didn't make it. So that's why they ran that thing today from Chicago.
Oh, no, that reveals something, very, in my opinion, very negative to the critic, because it's not necessary. That kind of a critique is not necessary. You don't
really
have to like
not.
Something and still express yourself a little bit better. And,
I think so. Again,
art is built on other previous art, not.
Exactly. I mean, was it supposed to sound like nobody ever? This is a man who's
written, you know, plagiarizing. Huh. Yeah.
The funny thing is, he said in a throwaway line in the Vanity Fair article, which I wonder if that Chicago woman read. You remember he said about the little joke about one of his film scores, Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. I mentioned. He said, "Oh yes, I robbed Shostakovich blind." I mean, and which was funny and probably also true, and, you know, he's cranking out the movies. He's very open and honest about the people that influenced him, Strauss. And, yeah, it's good to pick out influences and figure out where somebody gets certain ideas or structures, and there's nothing wrong, as you said. Everything's based on people. So, but you can use that if you're a fussy critic against the person. It's like saying, West Side Story isn't really any good because Shakespeare already did Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah. That's a good point. Did you get the tapes, your sister's taping of your dad while
Oh, no, I didn't yet, but I will.
And also, you were going to give me the antique magazine that had Elizabeth Taylor and the pearls on it?
Well, that I could do right now if you'll get it back to me.
I have to give it back to you.
Ooh,
what I brought back for you. Ooh, la la.
Oh, you have returnees. Your library, you don't get the 5-cent fine. Oh, forgot all about that. Good, let me sneak past again.
Rowan felt that, here, let's point a month.
Just a month.
Just a month. Okay.
You know what, there is, let me take a quick, there's a place that I think, right, not in the third, first floor, but I'm not talking where I'm on. I thought one other funny thing that Andre said to somebody out the window. asking him about, somebody asked him what the first opera he'd ever seen was, and he said his father took him at the age of 7 to, in Berlin, to see Salome, at which this, for a 7-year-old, quite an opera. So he had no idea what was going on, really. And the Germans, whoever mounted the production, thought it was, you know, because it just has no intermission, it's rather short, that it should be on a double bill. So there was an intermission that was billed with the second half, the second opera. The other half of the program was Coppelia. Quite a combination. And Andre said, I went out of there thinking that King Herod ran a toy shop.
That's wonderful. That's a good story. All right. You talked about...
I'm listening. I'm getting ready. Go ahead.
Investigative reporting.
Mm-hmm.
And you started to talk about it, and then we ended.
What about?
First of all, Nancy, it seems to be... Gabby had a question about it. Just in general, investigative reporting, you evidently had a problem in that article that biographical sketch about your problems with QED, etc., because you were doing something.
Post-Gazette.
Okay, so, and then we all know that it has evolved. Investigative report is almost being reinvented again.
Nowadays.
Yes. So I'd just like you to comment.
Oh. Well, I can only tell you my experience. Well, I can also tell you my high-blown opinion, but I'll do both as briefly as possible. I'm out of the high, used to be called advocacy journalism period, from Hunter Thompson, mainly in the epitome, the apex of which was Watergate, of course, in the Washington Post, and Woodward and Bernstein, which changed the whole face of reporting, investigative reporting, for the better. The crimes of Richard Nixon would not have been exposed had it not been for the Washington Post.
And you give Bradley and Mrs. Graham credit? Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, they did it in the face of terrible threats and, you know, nervousness. And it spawned a whole new... Well, you know, Hunter Thompson came, in a way, first. And he was the outrageous one, you know, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and on the campaign trails. His set book, Fear and Loathing in the Campaign Trail 72, is a great book.
What about Walter Winchell? Did he start it?
Well, I guess you could... I'm not a big Walter Winchell fan, but he was certainly in the tradition of journalists who were gutsy. Also, though, according to many people, in the tradition of journalists who were corrupt. You know, The Sweet Smell of Success, the Tony
exactly.
Curtis movie we've talked about, is fictionalized for it. It's like the Citizen Kane is Hearst's.
Winchell
is, and I hated this new biography of Winchell. Anyway, but yeah, there are those people in the tradition. But after Watergate and serious reporters, especially young ones, did similar digging into all sorts of things and came up with, the other crucial thing was actually first, before Watergate, was the reporting in Vietnam, which... It's just a big piece in the paper you may have seen, it was in Bob Hoover's book review yesterday of Reporting Vietnam, the new 2-volume set. These guys and women changed the whole way of reporting war, and the military subsequently figured out that they were never going to let that happen again, and the whole coverage of the Gulf War is a good example of how they've since caved in and keep the media in a little... and well away from everything. Anyway, I was much in that, in the middle of that theory and practice, and especially when Myrna and I had, well, even at the Wichita Eagle, I was especially interested in two areas, gun control and utility, Bell Telephone utility rate cases. The most boring thing in the world to most people, but for some reason, I was obsessed with this and did a lot of investigative stories about Bell Telephone consumer ripoffs in the guise of how they did the accounting. And that was when we came here, did the same thing for the Post-Gazette, and that's what ended up getting me.
And it's coming up again.
And it's coming up. Of course, since then, there was the breakup of Bell,
right.
Which was, my analogy is, it was the, like Br'er Rabbit saying, you know, don't throw me in the briar patch. Do anything you want, but don't throw me in the briar patch. And Bell said, do anything you want, but don't break us up. And they got away with murder. And that's the stories here that I did that were proven with photographic evidence of millions of dollars of fraudulent equipment charged to consumers. We had photographs of it being destroyed. And the important thing was not just Western Pennsylvania, but that I had lots of indications that if the total amount of the fraud here was in something like $12 million figures, which it was, that if you multiplied that by every major urban area in the country, you would get into the billion. But unfortunately, I got fired before I was able to do all that. But in the 3, 4, 5 years before that, I did a 7-part investigative report for the Post-Gazette on real estate price fixing commission, which they were so furious about, they took out full page ads in every paper in this area to denounce, which is the greatest tribute compliment to a reporter. And that won several awards here. That won a Golden Quill Award and the Matrix Award. I did the whole thing, a 2-part series with Albert French, the photographer, on the Cuban refugee Mariel boatlift in 1980. Remember when Castro threw out, let everybody come out in the boats, including all the criminals and the crazy people. Al and I went down to Key West. I got another, what else?
They sent them back, didn't they?
Well, lots of them. And then they sent many of them to the Indiantown Gap, PA, to the holding facility. So I was doing lots and lots of that stuff. And so we're just in my area. And so were people all around the country. And since then, you know, without going into it in great detail, we have Monica Gate and the obsession with such trivia. I mean, regardless of what you think about Clinton and Monica, and of course he's totally guilty of everything. doesn't seem to be much doubt about that. But it's the triviality of it. The issue of perjury in a affidavit in a civil case that was dismissed, if that's impeachable.
I don't think so.
So kill me, you know, but it's such much ado. And, you know, TV's to blame for a lot of it, but the newspaper business is not what it used to be in terms of, for one thing, there's so many fewer papers. You know, they're all getting eaten up, and one paper per town is now the rule. And it's still a lot of good people. I don't know, I think the press is a good example. There's two stories that the press won Pulitzers for. The first one was pretty good. The organ transplant scam, that was a pretty important story. Andrew Schneider. The second one was the most astonishing piece of drivel about U.S. air pilots doing cocaine in the air. Turned out, you know, this thing that was supposed to be a terrible scandal and threat to... They had something like one... They had two incidents, one proven and one alleged. They won a Pulitzer Prize for this.
Yeah.
Boy, and it's just an example of how, well, of course, drug offenses are on a par, in my mind at least, with sex offenses. They're these, it's the old vice, it's like prostitution. The Europeans have long since figured out, legalize the drugs, legalize prostitution, you know. If that's your the primary motivation of law enforcement and social stability in your country, you are wasting your time. And the media have reflected that. Instead of saying, this is bullshit, they go after it and they get Pulitzer Prizes for it. There'll be Pulitzers for Monica's dress, you know.
Well, look what happened with the Boston Globe, which is what, the New York Times, isn't it part of it? And then with the New Republic, where there's been plagiarizing.
Well, that's a whole...
People are fired.
Right.
Peter Arnett.
With Peter Arnett, who was great in Vietnam.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, there's those ethical matters, too, the plagiarism stuff. Well, the guy, the New Republic guy, Stephen Glass, that's pathological. That's remember the Tony Curtis movie, The Great Imposter? This guy just
takes on different personalities.
Well, this guy was a pathological, I mean, he not only made up and lied about everything in the story, but he elaborately concocted the supporting evidence and the backup documents for all of the fake people that are, and telephone numbers and email addresses, because he knew the New Republic has pretty good fact checkers. It's an astonishingly, it's a great story about it in the same issue of Vanity Fair as Mont Preventy. I don't know if you noticed it, but it's a blow-by-blow account of how he did it. It's fascinating. And the New Republic is pretty embarrassed about it. And Esquire. And Rolling Stone. He fooled all three of those magazines. Now, I will make one mistake in a factoid about, you know, the date of Lena Baskett's eighth marriage, and I get nailed for it at the New Yorker, as I should.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I read an article, and I'd like you to comment on it. I was mentioning it to Gabby. The cheapest programs to produce are news programs. The advertising is cheaper, evidently, and this is what's happening on television.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're watching. That's what you're hearing.
The CNN, poison gas story. Is that what you're thinking of most?
Well, that was part of that news.